Welcome to Film Studies Bling Bling, a podcast dedicated to the big and small treasures, hidden pearls and shining diamonds of film studies. My name is Anna Louise, and I'm the host of this podcast. This is the 14th episode. Today I'm very happy to present Senem Dürel Erkilic as my Bling of the Month. She's an expert in Turkish cinema and film and memory. I also have two great colleagues in the news chapter, Dario Linares and Neil Fox. Both are not only busy film scholars, but the hosts of the podcast The Cinematologists, a podcast that covers a large variety of film studies topics and that I can highly recommend. I have to admit, the news chapter is a kind of fan talk this time. The Dear Diary is about the Dial S for Screen Studies conference I attended and gave a talk at. Well, it wasn't a talk in the classical sense, but more about this in a moment. Let's start with my Bling of the Month. I'm very happy to welcome Senem Dürel Erkilic. Senem was born in Istanbul in 1971. She completed her undergraduate study at Mimar Sinan University, Istanbul, at the Film and TV Department in 1993, and took her master's degree from Chapman University in USA. She worked professionally as assistant director and second camera assistant on feature films, commercial films, and TV series, besides directing short films and documentaries. She performed her proficiency in art in Mimar Sinan University film and TV field. Senem became an associate professor in 2018 and professor in 2013. She became the head of radio, film and TV department in 2004 in Mersin University and later the dean of communication faculty at Mersin University between 2014 and 2020. Along with occupying the position of head of cinema department, she's currently leading an interdisciplinary program called Media, Culture, and Urban Studies at Mersin University. Her academic field of study involves Turkish cinema, cinema history, and memory relationship, documentary film, and film language. She has articles and papers on relevant subjects in various journals and books. She is the author of History and Memory in Turkish Cinema from 2014, and she gives lectures on Turkish cinema, constructing history and memory in film, cinema, society and memory at graduate level. Hello, Senem. Welcome to Film Studies Bling Bling.
Hi. Thank you, Anna. It's great to be your guest here.
I'm so excited. Senem, let's start first with your way into film studies. You started working in film practice, right? And how did it come about that you became increasingly interested in research on Turkish film history and film and memory?
Oh, thank you again, Anna. Really, I feel very privileged to be in your podcast. I'd like to answer this question by, as you said, by going back to my first years in university. When I was a film student in Mimar Sinan University, I was also working in commercials as a second camera assistant, as you said. And later on, I worked as assistant director in feature films and television series. And also, I was trying to shoot my own short films, actually, for school. I continued to work at the sector in a different position until I started focusing on film in an academic aspect. And with my friends, actually, we were very enthusiastic about shooting our own short films. And we were very lucky because most of the lecturers and professors in our school were very important film directors who were actually key actors of Turkish cinema, who mostly worked during 1960s and 70s. So actually, I'd like to mention their name here. Maybe you might know some of them. Lütfi Akat, Metin Erksan, Halit Refi, Duygu Sağaroğlu, İlhan Erekon. They experimented and researched for new narratives in Turkish cinema, and they mostly told stories in a realistic approach, and they tried to develop a certain language in film. They searched for a unique narrative, which probably affected today's independent filmmakers' film language, actually, in Turkey. And their movies are mostly based on migration, urbanization, problems of urban life, feudalism, and and rural life modernization of Turkey in general. So their films were underlying a social, historical, and political aspects in Turkey. Also, Professor Sami Şekeroğlu, who is the founder of the National Film Archive, was my supervisor. Mr. Şekeroğlu was also the founder of film school in Turkey, who brought these directors together for cinema education in 1970s. My answer to this question might seem a little long, more than expected actually, because this is beyond my academic interest. In where and from whom I got this film education are both significant considering the school and my teacher's background as in film sector and academia. So as I started taking these classes from these great people, I automatically actually found myself in the middle of the history of Turkish cinema. So I can easily say that I was raised within the history of Turkish cinema. My first aim back then was to stay in professional filmmaking and direct my own films. My education was mostly based on film production. And to be able to continue focusing on the same field, I studied at Chapman. I received my MFA from there. And as you can imagine, being a film student in California was a magnificent experience for me. I was so lucky to have this chance to physically observe how the film industry works in the States, of course, even partially. So, moreover, I also took part in independent filmmaking practices in California. And after my return from States, I started to work in Mimar Sinan University Cinema Television Institute as a research assistant. And in Turkey, if you go into academics, it's very difficult to stay in the production side of filmmaking. In Turkey, when you start working as an academic, it becomes harder to manage both the theoretical and practical sides together to carry out that together. And so after making several short films and a couple of documentaries, I started to become more involved in film studies. And my academic interest is very much related and driven by the millennium, entering the 2000. Right before entering the millennium, the issues like remembering the past, reckoning with the past century has come up to our lives more dramatically than before. I was very much impressed by Andreas Hüsen's book called Twilight Memories, Making Time in a Culture of Amnesia. In that book, cultural critic Andreas Hüsen tells about a special moment just before the sunset, which is a unique time of the day. He describes this time as an exclusive, special moment to deal with the problems of the day. It's a unique time for memory, or a special moment for remembrance. And in his book, he describes the end of 1990s as a time to remember all the past issues. It's like the twilight of the century. So this book and many others like Connerton's How Societies Remember affected me deeply. Since 2000, in Turkestan especially, in independent films, memory, the remembering, forgetting paradox, facing the past in the context of identity, recording the past and retrieving records have been frequently used as the main narrative elements in Turkish films. So in the meantime, in the light of these actually eye-opening studies, I decided to work more on memory and also history in, of Turkish cinema.
And how much does your practical film experience inform your teaching and research today? Would you say still a practitioner who is also a researcher with this focus on memory? Or are you a researcher who also teaches film practice?
I'm a researcher, probably, who teaches film practice more than 15 years, 18 years to be exact. I believe film practice and theory goes hand in hand. We cannot really separate them from each other. When we are talking about the history of film in Turkey, I believe we also have to talk about the social, political, technological influence of them too. My background in filmmaking inherently forms my teaching journey in a very positive way. My teaching of techniques and aesthetics of filmmaking by heart wouldn't be possible without my filmmaking experience. When it comes to research, it might seem slightly different, but still I think my practical background contributes a lot. The research process itself is a matter of piecing things together, organizing ideas, discussing them, editing these ideas. And these are the common ones, but academic work has its own nature and different rituals, probably.
And where do your students go after their studies, into film practice or film studies? I mean, you open up both worlds in a way.
Yes, I believe that too, Anna. I believe both. But to be more specific, our undergraduate students are trained for the sector, so they choose the practical side mostly. A small number of our students, however, are targeting an academic career, but it's better not to, as you said, oversimplify this like one way or the other, because in the case of Turkey, it's more complicated. As I mentioned before, practice and theory can't be separated from each other. There cannot be a cinema without a theory, or there cannot be a theory by being unaware of filmmaking practices. In Mersin University, we prepared a curriculum that emphasizes the beneficial aspects and features of both the practical and theoretical side of cinema education, but still, there are some structural problems on both sides. The list is quite long. I prefer not to go deep in these issues, but I will just give you a rundown to give a better idea of that long list. There are right now more than 70 departments named Radio, Film and Television Department under the name of Communication Faculty. Most of them lack of sometimes substance of film classes and or lectures specialized in filmmaking or film theory. There is a problem, the most important issue. There are only few film schools specialized in filmmaking, but there is still no separate film school in Turkey. Mm-hmm. So even if the students go to one of these departments of film school, after what happens next is always sometimes, I should say, unclear, because as I said before, it's also difficult to be in the film sector, and there are some structural problems that we'll probably talk about it later on.
Senem, what is that fascinates your students about film history in general and Turkish film history in particular, or rather, in what way does your enthusiasm for film history inspire your students, no matter whether they start to work in film practice or become a film scholar in the future?
I guess what really fascinates my master's and PhD students about the history of film is that history is not something that is completed. It's a continuous process. With new perspectives and approaches, with the help of new evidence, we can write that history in a different way. It's not a concrete element. So film history is like a living organism. Historical films not only tell stories about past, but also these films themselves give us clues of that specific time period when they were produced. Movies take a picture of the social, political background of a certain time period. Also, as Mark Farrow, Robert Rosenstone, Pierre Solin, and many other writers, historians, think that film is a construction of history. But Rosenstone's question is very important. Who speaks for the past, he asks. He also says that new history of film provides a series of challenges to written history. From this important argument, we try to look at the social and cultural history held by Turkish films. And these are probably the main reasons for motivation to study film history for my students.
And you are also the head of the PhD program Media, Culture and Urban Studies in Mersin University. What role does film play in the PhD program? Are there any works that you supervise specifically dedicated to film or film history?
Oh, thank you. I would like to first talk a little about this program. Mm-hmm. Media, Culture and Urban Studies is an interdisciplinary PhD program that we established in 2012 in Mersin University. And the interest and the need for this interdisciplinary approach, mostly based on the curiosity to research, understand, analyze, and transfer today's social conditions and structure to our academic focuses. Media, Culture and Urban Studies PhD program, inspired by this determination, and it aims to produce ideas, contribute to critical thinking in the field where the disciplines of radio, television, cinema, journalism, political science, architecture, urban and regional planning, philosophy and sociology intersects with each other. We believe that it's important to comprehend the transitivity of these fields. The program aims to provide students from different perspectives with the opportunity to discuss and relate contemporary theories on various topics, from popular culture to urban and environmental studies, from politics to history, from urban design to new media, and to cinema, of course, and to examine them from an original perspective. Our aim is to open a new interdisciplinary area for researchers, which is a pretty unique program actually in Turkey. FİM is also an intersection point of these fields. We have lectures and discussions on topics such as film and space, representation of urban and rural spaces in film, space of memory and construction of Pierre Nora's as a lieu de mémoire in film, and so on. Our compulsory lectures are given by two or three professors from these different departments. By this way, we are trying to establish a common language and bring different fields' perspectives together. The works I'm currently supervising are mostly focused on the concept of leisure right now. So it's not really related to film, unfortunately. We have another PhD program, of course, in film and television department, and I'm giving lectures there. And also I have students who are preparing their pre-PhD theses there.
I mentioned at the beginning that you are the author of the book Türk Sineması Data Hibelik, which can be translated as History and Memory in Turkish Cinema. Unfortunately, I'm so sorry, because it has up till now been published only in Turkish. I could not read the book, but with the help of a translation program, I was at least able to understand that it is about the representation of history in Turkish cinema. You analyze what you call a cinema of memory, which has been created in Turkey since 2000. I mean, you mentioned at the very beginning your research focus on millennium and films in this context, memory. It is a film corpus which reveals suppressed traumas and which rethinks social history through remembrance. Would you like to tell us about this work in a few words? I mean, it's nearly impossible, but try to put it in a nutshell.
Thank you again, Anna. As you say, it's published only in Turkish now, unfortunately. Hopefully, I can get it published in other languages. My book looks into the relationship between history, memory, and cinema, and I try to draw a theoretical background and analyze some historical films, starting from the 1950s, and focus on the films produced after 2000. Enzo Treverzo describes history as a battlefield of politics. His definition fits very well into the context of cinema. I give examples from Turkish film history that representations of the past in films have always been a battleground for politicians or politics. And not only films, but the past itself was intertwined with and shaped by censorship. Films were censored by authorities. So I focused on films that are constructing our past and memory, films that are opening new channels to us for remembering the past. These films, in conjunction with the changing political atmosphere in Turkey at the very beginning of 2000, show the tendency of confronting the forgotten, as you said, the suppressed and the things that we have not been expressed before. These films created an area of resistance to the fictional characteristics of the hegemonic past. I call them cinema of memory, in that they recreated history in a different context. If my book gets translated into English or other language, probably I would like to add another chapter to this book for the last 5-6 years of Turkish cinema.
And are there articles by you in English on film and memory that you can recommend as an alternative? I mean, we have to wait a bit until the book will be available in a rewritten version. So maybe in the meantime, we can have a look at some articles of yours.
Yes, actually, I can tell you some of my articles written in English, but I should probably start from one thing that I should say. Actually, we have been able to see publications about Turkish cinema in different languages increasingly in the last 10 years. Mm. But before, there weren't so many. So Turkish cinema remained almost as a black box for decades and for international academia, I should say. Mm. But of course, there are remarkable books right now about Turkish cinema published in English. For example, Asuman Suner's New Turkish Cinema, Belonging, Identity and Memory, it's called, its title was it. Or Savaş Aslan's Cinema in Turkey, a New Critical History. And there are some other edited books in different languages about Turkish cinema. And one of them is also in English, Imaginary is Out of Place, Cinema Transnationalism in Turkey. Gökçen Karanfil and Serkan Şak are the editors of this book. And with Hakan Erkılıç, we have a chapter in that book. It's titled The Black Humor World of Migrants, caught by between two cultures, space, identity and belonging in Tunç Okan's cinema. Mm-hmm. Tunç Okan is a very interesting and unique filmmaker from 1970s. In that chapter, we analyzed Tunç Okan's films within the framework of some concepts like xenophobia, subaltern and migration cinema. We also have an article in English with Hakan Erkılıç again titled Does a Documentary Change Remembrance and Truth in Ayrılığın Yurdu Hüzün and Yeni Bir Yurt Edinmek? These are, in that article, we focus on the concepts of remembrance, memory, trauma and mourning through Enis Rıza's documentaries Ayrılığın Yurdu Hüzün, which means sorrow, homeland for separateness, and Yeni Bir Yurt Edinmek, adopting a new homeland. These are the documentaries made in 2001 and 2006. These documentaries are actually based on 23 population exchange between Turkey and Greece. So we discussed the role of documentaries in the construction of collective memory. Another one is Arabesque Narrative in New Turkish Cinema. Is it synthetic? The title is that. In that article, we look at Turkish cinema, which is mostly symbolized with the directors such as Nuri Bilge Ceylan, Zeki Demirkubuz. And in this article, we are mostly searching for the differences and resemblances of old and new Turkish cinema. And our key concepts in this research are melodrama and arabesque narrative. So we have actually three articles written in English, and probably the listeners of this podcast can maybe reach them if they want.
You send me your recommendations, book recommendations, and a list with all your English articles you would like to recommend. And then we put them in the podcast description and footnotes and on my webpage so that all the listeners have the possibility to go on with further reading on Turkish film history and Turkish cinema after listening to the podcast. What do you think about this?
Oh, that's great. It's a good idea. Thank you.
Senem, at the Screen Studies Conference, I had the opportunity to hear you give a talk entitled Intermittent Du Spektakel Can Be a Model for the Film Industry in Turkey? The lecture is related to your current research project titled COVID-19, Pandemic and Crisis of Turkish Film Industry. First, tell us about the general framework. You're not working on it alone and the project is third-party funded, and maybe also about the runtime of the project.
The main interest of our research is the crisis in cinema sector caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the change in the value chain. There's a massive global transformation and crisis in the cinema industry that emerged with the pandemic. Our project aims to address all aspects of crisis in the film industry in Turkey during the pandemic and try to find out some solutions. Yes, as you mentioned, Hakan Erkılıç is conducting our research project. Our economist friend, Professor Süleyman Değirmen, and me, we are the researchers of the project. We also have four PhD students working with us. I'd like to mention their name here too. Selver Dikkol, Servet Can Dönmez, Onur Aytaç, and Nil Yüce. As a team, we work together with pleasure. Thank you for mentioning our presentation at the Diales Screen Studies Conference. It was titled as Intermittent Du Spektakel Can Be a Model for the Film Industry in Turkey.
Thank you.
No, yeah. It's difficult. I'm not familiar with French either. This presentation was part of our project and actually one of the subtopics we took out of this study. This is a short-term, six-month project supported by TÜBİTAK. It's the Scientific and Technological Research Council of Turkey. The project is mainly based on the impact of COVID-19 pandemic in Turkish film industry, and at the end of this month, we will try to wrap it up. And Turkey was announced a support package under the name of Economic Stability Shield Package. The cinema sector also benefited from this support on some issues as short-time working allowance and various tax delays. Behind the camera workers are freelancers, and unfortunately they couldn't benefit from this package. Under the leadership of the Cinema Broadcasting Union, 4 million Turkish lira, it's about 414,000 euros, worth of Netflix support package was distributed to the behind-the-camera employees of the productions whose shootings were interrupted due to the pandemic. In this context, the COVID-19 Film and Television Relief Fund realized in cooperation with the Cinema Broadcasting Union, İKSV, which is Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Arts, and Netflix. The support program, in accordance with the project-based work environment of the sector, includes freelancers and numerous behind-the-camera employees. I must emphasize that COVID-19 Films and Television Relief Fund was the first and only civil society support initiative specific to the film industry in Turkey. One-time amount distributed per person was about 260 euro. This amount is only a little more than the minimum wage, and it was given to about 1,400 people. Apparently, this is very insufficient as a financial support. Last week, the Ministry of Culture and Tourism Cinema Fund announced 50 million Turkish lira support package for movie theaters, which is good right now. At the end of this project, we will propose a model like an intermittent work in France for freelancers due to the structural problems deepened by the COVID-19 pandemic. We are facing the rise of digital platforms. We will suggest that 2% of the annual revenues of the digital platforms can be transferred to the movie theaters. And in accordance with the project-based nature of cinema sector, we will suggest establishing a support fund for crisis periods. And to create a source for this fund, we will suggest transferring the copyright levy income to this fund. One of our suggestions is going to be transfer a certain percentage of chance games to this fund too, and so on. Still, we are working on it.
What is the observation underlying the project, or how did you come up with the topic? Was there an initial moment for this project?
Turkish cinema experienced a popcorn crisis in 2019. This crisis was caused by the disagreement between the producers and the owner of movie theaters on the percentage of ticket revenues. Afterwards, some legal regulations were made on this issue. And finally, the COVID crisis broke out. While trying to understand and evaluate this as a whole, the project idea came up. During our research, we clearly realized that the problem caused by COVID-19 pandemic consists of structural problems already in the cinema sector, and the pandemic is deepening all these problems in Turkey. We can understand the magnitude of the crisis in Turkey by giving some numbers. 2020, box office loss of audience is 95% when we compare to the year 2019. And the loss of the revenue is 65% in 2020. I'd like to give you an overall situation about the film productions in Turkey at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. According to the Cinema Broadcasting Union data, 39 television series, 12 film sets, and 60 commercial sets were stopped during the crisis. So these are some numbers to demonstrate the situation, and still we have some film sets going on, but probably they are going to end again very soon.
What are the central issues you're addressing in this very short six-month period of research time you have?
We are focusing on the impact of pandemic in certain headlines, such as screenings, production side of it, freelancers, mostly behind the camera employees, film festivals and support mechanism, authorities' way of handling the whole situation. This is the main framework of our project.
It became clear from your lecture that there is this sort of comparison between Turkey and France plays a role in your project. Can you explain this to us?
One of our main topics, as I said, was about freelancers. Today, the film industry is mostly defined as project-based work organization in terms of film production. The film crew and technicians work as freelancers. Along with neoliberalism in creative industries, flexible and uninsured work increased. The precarious nature of creative and cultural work is a phenomenon that is ignored by politicians, even so. It's largely debated in academic literature. Although it varies by country, freelancers and their legal status is a complex issue. Film industry in France is a good example with the implementation of intermittent du spectacle, that means intermittent entertainment worker. This regulation's history dates back to 1936, includes cinema, theater, dance, music, and circus workers. The purpose of this definition is to enable employees in this field to survive when they are not working and to prepare without hesitating for new projects. They are required to document 500 hours of work per year. This is especially an unemployment benefit. According to the data of France from this year, there are 270,000 people getting support within this scope. In Turkey, freelancers cannot get benefit from social security coverage because of their status. They are not considered full-time or part-time. As a result of this, they cannot benefit from full-time employment aids such as social security and pension. Also, mostly their allowances are not paid timely and regularly, which makes their lives harder. As we mentioned, the pre-pandemic period for freelancers in Turkey, actually, in our research, working conditions have already been problematic. During the pandemic, these structural problems came to the surface, as we talked before with you. But as we saw in figures and numbers of supports and interviewed professionals, these problems cannot be overcome by civil initiatives alone. Even if the pandemic ends, its impact on industry will resonate as it has a stone thrown into the water. It's clear that we will face similar problems in the coming years. We believe such regulations about social security and implementation in France could be a good model for film workers in Turkey to cope with this problematic nature of freelance and survive through unexpected solutions such as this pandemic.
As you are working in a team, let us talk about methods. What are your methods? I mean, I'm quite sure that there are different methods with which you are addressing this huge topic of crisis in Turkish film industry and how to organize the structures of Turkish film industry in the future after the pandemic.
Because, as you said, the scope and multi-layered structure of this project, we used a mixed method. Qualitative and quantitative method together. The method of the study adopts the contextual approach, comprising in-depth interviews and focus group meetings held, as well as the examination and analysis of secondary sources, including law, legislation, report, economic analysis, along with insights and literature. And we had in-depth interviews with about 50 people from the industry. We held meetings with chain theater companies, independent theater companies, mainstream producers, art house producers, directors, festival directors, film festival directors, representatives of cinema professionals, union executives, and state employees, of course. We conducted a literature review on support and prevention mechanism in the world as well. To get a global aspect, we try to do all this. It's a very short time period actually to do this project in 6 months, but probably this showed us that we have to make another project for the structural problems, really focusing on other structural problems beyond COVID-19.
So there is a certain urgency in this project.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. When can we read your results, Senem?
We will have delivered the project by January 2021. We are trying to disseminate our study results with related articles, lectures, and presentations. And maybe this podcast will help us to share our findings with other academicians and authorities related to these issues.
Would be a pleasure. Yeah. That would be great to have a special episode maybe on your findings. That would be great. And maybe with your colleagues as well.
Oh, I mean, that would be great. Yes.
Yeah,
especially yeah. I'd like to maybe to be with our PhD students here because they are working really hard on it too.
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Many thanks, Thanem, for the interview. I was really delighted that we met virtually in Sydney and now again in the podcast. I wish you and your colleagues every success with the research project. And as we said, we have an appointment for a special episode on the results. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Anna. It was a great pleasure to be your guest. And thank you for your kind wishes. And I also wish you good luck on your work and hope we will meet again soon.
This is the news chapter. In this chapter, I have two great colleagues with me, Dario Linares and Neil Fox. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you on my podcast.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for having us.
You both have really remarkable academic biographies, but I can only present your work here in a much too short version. I start with Dario. Dario is a principal lecturer in contemporary screen media at the University of Brighton. He has published work on a range of topics, including the astronaut in American culture, British prison film, the cinemas as time machine, the cinematic experience in digital age. And together with Neil and Richard Berry, he has published a book on podcasting too. I'll come to this and another publication of yours on podcasting a bit later. And then we have Neil. Neil is a senior lecturer in film at the Falmouth University, where he also leads a pedagogic research and innovation program and is responsible for the Sound Image Cinema Lab. He is an award-winning screenwriter whose debut feature, Wilderness, had an international digital release in the autumn of this year. He is currently writing a book on music documentaries and concert film that will be published in 2022 by the publisher BFI Bloomsbury. This is a kind of super short fan interview today because I'm an enthusiastic listener of your podcast, The Cinematologists, which I would really like to draw the listeners' attention to here and really recommend. As the title suggests, your podcast has something to do with cinema, obviously, but what I really like is that it's not just another male buddies talk about film. I think you know what I mean. But rather a kind of audio film analysis and audio film research. You offer your listeners so much that there are interviews with media and film scholars about their research, reports from and talks about film festivals. We have panel discussions with a variety of experts, deep film analysis, a wealth of diverse topics, including sports documentaries, pop culture criticism, intros to individual directors and their work, and much, much more. One can literally listen to you, I would say, and your guest, thinking about film, so to speak, and above all, experience what is going on in your everyday academic life. We can literally share your work or the life you live as an academic. So please go into more detail. How would you describe the profile of your podcast?
Do you want to take that one, Dario?
All right. Don't pass straight over to me. Well, I mean, you've summed it all up there, really. I mean, we kind of started with not really too much of an inkling of the direction that it would go. I mean, we didn't sort of understand what it would become, I don't think. I mean, originally, we were really interested in utilizing the cinema space. So the idea of doing tapings in a live screening. So that kind of was the central mechanism by which we sort of developed the structure of the podcast that we had. So we taped an intro to a movie, whether it's in the university or outside, an audience would sit and watch it. And then we would record a kind of Q&A afterwards. And unlike normal Q&As, we usually didn't have the filmmaker in attendance or somebody connected with the film in attendance. So it left open the possibility for lots of different types of discussion topics and even criticisms of the film, which was really interesting. And then I think at the start, Neil and I, when Neil joined Falmouth University, when I was there, we kind of recognized a kindred spirit in terms of not maybe necessarily in every film that we agree on, but in terms of our interest in talking about films and also sort of working through why we like stuff and why we didn't like stuff. And I think both in the podcast that we enjoyed listening to, we felt that there was a sort of gap for work that was trying to make an academic analysis of films more accessible. And then in the universities that we worked in, the sort of the ability to be able to have a kind of free conversation and go in lots of different directions and not be conformed by certain expectations or structures of output, as you'll know, in terms of being an academic, that freedom kind of was really, really attractive. And it's kind of led us onto lots of different types of podcasts in the last sort of five and a half years.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that you sort of said it's not just another male buddies talk about films podcast, which was definitely something that we didn't want it to be, and that we're still very conscious of it not ever really being, you know, our awareness of our whiteness and our maleness is ever present in our life and certainly in the podcast. And but more than that, it, you know, you sort of say there about academic analysis, we're not the same kind of academics. We both publish academically, but we both have very different approaches. We have very different interests and we come at it from different angles. And the aim was always to have a space where all of the different sides of our critical personalities could come out. When we wanted to be fans, we would be fans. When we wanted to be academics, we would be that. And bringing in kind of film criticism, film practice, podcasting practice was kind of key, just like Darius says, to do with the freedom. What's been interesting, and sort of you sort of brought out about talking about our academic life, is that we're also interested in academia and academia's place in the world and podcasting's place and film's place within that. So it does provide a space for everything. And because we don't see ourselves as kind of being defined by one of those positions, they're always present and they're always kind of bleeding in and out of the podcast, which I think is why it has grown the way it has. And you know you're listening to The Cinematologist, but you know you're listening to The Cinematologist because of the blend of possible experiences that might come out of listening to it.
So there is diversity on different levels, I would say. Your podcast is very diverse because of all the voices that are present in the podcast, the experts you're interviewing, these scholars that use the podcast to speak about their research, but it's also diverse in the sense you describe now, that you have this, you are underlining in a way the different identities you have as scholars, as fans, as just cinema goers or festival visitors. And all of this is present in this podcast. I really like that. Was that something that just happened, or is that something that you really sit down and would think like, okay, what can we do to have this diversity in our podcast?
I think the diversity of voices is kind of twofold, really, in terms of, yes, an awareness of not wanting it to be a podcast where you just hear two white men talk about films by white men. You know, we're not interested in that kind of cinema. We don't privilege our position in terms of being overly knowledgeable about the entirety of cinema in order to be able to kind of do that comfortably. Not that that even would be a good thing. So it's always been a desire of ours to bring in as many different voices as possible, but mainly because we like talking to our colleagues and we like talking to filmmakers and critics about film. So it was a platform to be able to do that, which felt quite natural. And I think that also the kind of films that we want to talk about are so wildly different. We both have a kind of a very wide taste, but more than that, a wide interest in talking about as wide a kind of spectrum as possible. So the types of films that you're talking about and the types of directors that you're talking about often dictate how you're going to talk about them and who you might then invite to talk about them. So it's, again, it's just kind of curiosity and interest. And I think as well, an internal interest in terms of picking films. You know, like a recent example would be the sports documentary, which has long been Dario's really desired podcast. You know, we've been talking about it for a long time. He's really, really wanted to do it. And I know that part of that is he wants to talk to me about it. And I want to talk to him about it because I know he's passionate about it. And there is that sense of sharing passions and sharing interests with the other person and seeing their take and their perspective on it, which will, yeah, kind of only kind of enhance ours, I think.
Yeah. Just very quickly on diversity of form, I think that we very early on decided that we didn't want to do kind of seasons or genres, you know, over a series of episodes. And I think, you know, part of that is because with our academic lives, you know, we can't always guarantee when shows are going to happen. It just, you know, we try to do two a month during the academic year, but things can happen, obviously, and stuff can get in the way. And then at different times, more and more, we get approached by people about different things. And we haven't always, say, for example, we try not to sort of jump on a bandwagon. If somebody contacts us and says, oh, can you advertise my movie? We often kind of reject those projects. Sometimes we take those on if there's a particular interest. But I think also I'm always interested, and I know Neil is too, in terms of where we can go in terms of form and what different things we can do. And sometimes just we'll fancy a podcast, which is just me and him, like the end of year kind of review is just me and Neil really talking about films we've liked. But then whether it's sports documentaries or The Cinematic Voice, or Neil wants to do one on say punk cinema, you know, all these things are open to consideration. And we really, over the years, we've only had one rule, which is that Neil and I will always introduce and always sum up a podcast at the beginning and the end. And within that, then there's quite a lot of freedom for experimentation.
If someone is listening and is not sure whether to study film studies or not, just listen to the Cinematologist podcast and then you get a really good impression how cool it can be to be a film scholar and how much enthusiasm is in this research field. I think that's really a key inspiring moment of your podcast.
Thank you.
You can really experience diversity and this enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's kind. Thank you.
You've been producing your podcast for 5 years now and have already produced over 100 episodes. I mean, that's amazing. During that time, the podcast has also changed, I would say, both technically and in terms of content and format. Can you roughly describe the main lines of development? Is it possible to describe main lines of development?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's funny that you say you've had over 100 episodes, and we're always conscious that we're not producing enough because, you know, there's so many episodes. There's podcasts out there that produce every week and twice a week, and now, you know, there's daily podcasts. So we're always conscious of that fact. But I think because our podcasts are quite long, longer than average, and longer than is advised if you listen to the podcast's gurus. But yeah, I think because we worked at the same university, it made the structuring quite straightforward. We could be in the same room to tape together when it was the discussion part of the podcast. Like I say, we tried to structure around live screenings on a regular basis at the beginning, and often had interviews again that were conducted live. And I think the major kind of change in that was when I left and went to the University of Brighton, and there was a discussion about whether we would continue and how we would continue, and we were both up for continuing. And then I think that actually has allowed a sort of sense of freedom in terms of how we conduct the interviews and how we record. And again, it's difficult to say there's been a direct linear progression of we were like this and now we are like this. I think it's just a case of we're open to more and more possibilities of the podcasting form. And that has just been nice as we've gone along. I don't know if Neil agrees with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that change when Dario left Falmouth, it was quite early on in the podcast, you know, looking back, but the desire to continue, it definitely gave us the freedom to kind of explore what it could be. And that's where other voices came into the podcast kind of by necessity, because we were still doing a lot of live events. But I think as well that what's happened is that as we've kind of become engaged in podcast studies, our interest in using our own practice to explore what we're interested in terms of podcasting has kind of also emboldened that desire to make so many different kinds of episodes whenever things are interesting in terms of what's coming over from elsewhere. You know, I mean, certainly I'm interested in kind of curation and conversation. So you can certainly see a lot of that interest in what I've been wanting to do. And Dario's, you know, become, you know, amazingly kind of excited and involved and done some really great work in terms of the technological and kind of ideological junctures within podcast. I think you can definitely see that in the work. And that development, I think, is again, speaks to what we were saying at the start, that it's about how we're bringing everything that we're interested in into the table while remembering it's a film podcast, but also honoring those other aspects of our life and academic life as well.
I would say it's certainly apparent to everyone that it makes totally sense to not only write about film, but to realize video essays, right? In other words, to use moving images and sound and montage, etc., to reflect on film. But podcast, I mean, you don't just concentrate on cinematic voice and sound in your podcast, even if, for example, episode 98 about cinematic voice is extremely enriching. You reflect on moving images. Isn't podcast that functions as a research space on film and moving images a paradox of sorts?
Yeah, do you want me to go for that one, Neil?
I thought you'd be champing at the bit.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I've just written 10,000 words about that, really. So, I suppose I better take that one on. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating one. And again, I think it probably speaks to the ways in which in the digital age, you know, those boundaries between all media have kind of collapsed and maybe even made us realize that the boundaries that we associated with, say, film, television, radio in the 20th century that we kind of took for granted, those things are open to be looked back on as perhaps a lot more porous than we realize. I think what's interesting, particularly about film podcasts, is the way that films are talked about and the form of the podcast can kind of change depending on what kind of podcast you're thinking about. So I've just published this piece that talks a lot about film podcasts where it's very clear that the conversation and the voice and the arguments are about the film, and the film is the primary media and the podcasts act as a secondary medium upon which the interest and the development and the conversation is about, you know, what is cinema? What are these films like? And that separation is kept intact. But I think more and more there are podcasts that are incorporating elements of sound design and even elements of use of the voice and discussion mechanisms that actually try to tap into the listener's kind of audio imagination around their relationship to film. So I always use the example just as a very simple way of thinking about it is if you played the Jaws theme right now, what would that trigger in your mind? That would trigger something, I would say, that is related to your relationship with that film. You know, if you're growing up in that era, you know, the idea of going into the sea to swim suddenly became a really problematic thing because everybody had seen this movie and it terrified everyone, and that music was part of it. So is that triggering something imaginative in your mind that is related to your relationship to cinema? And I think that film podcasts are more and more tapping into that, and a lot of them basically using clips and using sound effects from movies is the most obvious way in which that happens. But I think the crossover into sound design and sound studies and that kind of thing that podcasts are using are becoming more and more interested in perhaps creating the idea of a cinematic experience that is without images.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll add a little bit to that, which is I think that the history of criticism is written and then was, you know, voice-based in the kind of, you know, with the evolution of radio, particularly kind of things like culture programs on the radio. But there's always been a tradition of receiving and then analysing audiovisual work, but also kind of visual work, fine art, photography, through the written word and then through the spoken word. So I think that podcasting both kind of follows a tradition of criticism where it's a kind of innate understanding that it's not the same medium doing the criticism that's done the original work. But what Daria's kind of alluding to there and what his piece does really well is kind of really start to make the case that podcasting is a really fascinating and kind of creative way of getting closer to that kind of original medium through its use of sound, but also the imaginary that comes through the sound and relates to the image in a way that does feel really exciting and really new. And it's good to be at the end of the sort of critical medium that's kind of really interested in how you might address that paradox, which is always going to be there, but kind of how it's fascinating to be played around with and how you can make it something more interesting than was possible before, certainly in kind of radio and, you know, written academic research or criticism terms.
I just want to add that for me, my podcast is also a tool for networking, because as a scholar starting in film studies, you hang around conferences, and if you're lucky, after some years, you are familiar with a group of people, your peers, and you see each other frequently on different conferences and so on. But sometimes it's a bit difficult that despite the research work you're doing, to get in contact with interesting people and to really talk with them, not just only reading their material. So for me, to be honest, it was also this idea that, well, with this podcast, I can just ask them to get in contact with them, to interview them about interesting books, about papers I read and so forth. This was just one aspect, my motivation to start with a podcast, to just really open up and be brave and just allow myself to speak with people. And I mean, all of them are willing to do, because to exchange and to speak about your work is something everyone enjoys and everyone loves to spread their enthusiasm. And sometimes it's easier to share this enthusiasm while speaking and not just only writing papers and books and so on.
Yeah, I think the academic writing, you know, has a kind of reputation for kind of presenting a kind of finality. And you know, it can be quite intimidating. And I think what's been amazing about podcasting and listening to podcasts, like you say, with critics or kind of academics, is realizing that so few of them think what they write is the final word on it and want the chance to expand and want the chance to kind of reframe their own positions and things. And I think that's a really exciting aspect of the medium. And it is great for kind of understanding how people think about the work that they do. So yeah, it's great that you've had that experience with your podcast, definitely.
And who are your listeners? Are these all only in quotation marks film scholars like me? How do you connect with your listeners? And who are maybe the future listeners you would like to win over for your podcast?
That's what we're always asking ourselves, really. It's a funny one.
I don't think it's only film podcasts. We, you know, that's a part of it. We know a lot of film critics listen to it. We know a lot of people in the film industry, you know, some filmmakers, but certainly people in distribution and exhibition. I think it's probably cinephiles as a kind of loose collective who are working in different areas. We have just people who love movies. And I think that connection is made because of the fact that we don't limit the podcast to being an academic podcast. We want to talk in depth and we want to be critical and we want to kind of have a variety of context, but we also want it to be accessible and interesting and be able to kind of switch to thinking about it in different ways. And that seems to have worked in terms of the fact that we built up an audience base of people from all different aspects of kind of film culture, but with an interest in kind of engaging with an approach to film discussion that isn't limited by a certain sort of set of parameters. And in terms of the future listeners, it's just those types of people that haven't heard the podcast yet, really.
Yeah, and I think what's really important, and maybe something unspoken between me and Neil, but I think it really is sort of key to the audience that we do have, is that we are academics, but when we don't talk to the audience in an academic way, and we're not stilted by, we try not to be stilted by academic formalism. And, you know, if you record a sort of keynote lecture and you put that out as a podcast, I find it incredibly dry to listen to. So there's moving away from that element, but also recognizing that we're not comedians or performers in that sense. So not kind of, you know, being untrue or being inauthentic in that way. So finding that sweet spot between those two positions, I think, is what we kind of subliminally try to do.
Yeah. Yeah, we like talking to each other. And I think that's always been the root of the podcast. I think I'm pretty funny. I don't know what Dario's going on about. But we're very reflective people. I think we're always thinking about how we sound, how we want to sound, how we want the podcast to feel, because that kind of reflexivity is kind of part of podcasting to a significant degree. I think it's found its audience, people who appreciate that. And I'm sure that there are people who've listened once because they liked a film that we've talked about and been absolutely turned off by it, you know, and have not returned. And that's fine, you know, that we're not looking to build an audience in a way that we need to do that. You know, I think we are fortunate in terms of it being part of our academic and kind of creative life that we can cultivate the audience that we've got and grow it kind of organically through kind of retaining on our path, which is thankfully creatively a quite an exploratory and kind of dynamic path, I think.
You develop different tools to expand your podcast in a way. I mean, there is a newsletter and there is a sort of in-group area on your webpage. Maybe you can give us an idea of that.
I think it just relates to that idea of making your podcast as discoverable as possible. And, you know, if you read much of the podcast studies work that is going on, you know, part of it is to do with how to improve searchability, how to be discoverable. And also, I think if you're an independent podcaster like we are, it's what is going to happen. How do you maintain your sense of presence and visibility when podcasting seems to be now moving much more towards a sort of broadcast channel format? If you think of what Spotify is doing and Google and the BBC, these kinds of organizations are trying to change podcasting in terms of its kind of structural gatekeeping and organization. So we're always trying to figure out ways in which we can sort of stay in the minds of our listeners and bring in new listeners. And I think the newsletter has been really interesting because, again, it was just one of these things we thought we'd try to help with our Patreon subscription. So we do have a Patreon page, which, you know, it's very cheap. It's only $2.50 a month we ask for. And really, it's just to help with running costs. We're not expecting to make any money, so we don't have that commercial element of it. But the newsletter actually has been really, really interesting, I think, from both Neil and I as writers, because it does have an audience, but a narrow audience and an audience that we know of. So therefore, we can kind of expand on areas which, you know, sometimes go outside of film and sometimes are a little bit more personal, and talk about things that is going to be read, but it's not going to be kind of just out on the internet for anyone to see. And then, of course, we just love doing the recommendations. And I think, you know, Neil's interest in curation feeds into this, and this interest in finding what your cultural highlights are, you know, in this world where we're bombarded from all avenues with content, and how do you sort through all of that? So, yeah, we're always looking for ways in which we can improve on that.
Before I was talking about networking, and I have to say that for me, the podcast was very important, especially now during the pandemic, during this corona crisis, because in a way, it was also this little window to the academic world while I'm sitting at home doing my research, conducting my research. How has the pandemic affected your podcast and maybe the podcast landscape in general? I have the impression that many new podcasts have been launched. For instance, artists in particular have turned to podcasts to reflect on their existence in lockdown. But also increasingly, scholars from different disciplines. At my university alone, I know of three new podcast projects that will be released soon. So how's your feeling about that, the pandemic and podcasting, the podcast landscape?
I think that it hasn't really changed our podcast very much. We were kind of pandemic proof in the sense that we've been working remotely on kind of piecing the podcast together sonically for a few years now, you know, since Dario moved. It's always been predominantly a remote recording and editing experience. A lot of our interviews are usually recorded as well. So we've been doing that kind of work where it's less about sitting in a room face to face and talking and then recording and editing. It's more about having a series of conversations that you're putting together. So in that sense, we were well placed, and we had a season ongoing as well. So because we plan our seasons and we know we're going to do, you know, we had most of those episodes that came out of that period lined up. I think maybe one dropped in at short notice, if I remember that far back. But generally speaking, we were just kind of maintaining our course, which was interesting. It did something which was, again, one of those little shifts that come in, which is that, you know, we had an episode with Mark Cousins where we both interviewed Mark Cousins at the same time online, something that I think people were much more accepting of in terms of being interviewed by two people, neither of whom were in the room with you. But also for us, it was a case of, you know, wanting to have conversations together. You know, normally an episode comes together sort of independently in terms of interviews, and maybe like if it's a live event in one of our locations, then we have a kind of joint conversation between me and Dario. But this felt like something actually more and more we don't have to worry about that, because nobody's going to be in the room with us. We're all going to be in separate places. And that was something that felt like a positive. And I think you've definitely seen that across the podcasting landscape is a much more accepting kind of willingness to want to talk from wherever, rather than kind of thinking that you have to arrange a place to do the thing, you know, which kind of makes sense because it is a digital medium, but it's not something that necessarily been as prominent, I don't think, as in the last few months.
And I mean, there was this wonderful episode you produced with, you were talking with colleagues about how it is to teach during the pandemic. Very encouraging episode, I would say. So you're reflecting on what it means to be an academic and to teach, especially how to reach and to still watch and experience films together during a time you can't be together. And I found this very fascinating, this particular episode.
That sense of what is happening in the pandemic and what's happening to cinema and what's happening to podcasting has kind of informed some of our discussions, you know, throughout the time of the pandemic. And what was interesting, one of the things that was interesting to me was how the big organizations were kind of dealing with the fact that they were suddenly in the same boat as we've always been in. In fact, I wrote a blog about how, you know, this sense of production values had sort of been upended a little bit when it comes to podcasting. And yeah, just on that discussion about film watching, and I think we're really sort of concerned, obviously, about what film is going to look like in 12 months a year, 12 months, and, you know, in the longer term, I should say. And I think that we're still up for a conversation, I think, about that from an industry perspective rather than just a, you know, an academic teaching perspective. But all of our sort of relationship to media and how it is produced and what makes good content and bad content, if I can use that horrible phrase, and how that's changed because of the parameters of what can be done remotely, I think is an interesting subject in and of itself.
Yeah, And I think just to add on that as well, one of the things I was concerned about, I think, as things have kind of gone on, was a kind of, you know, digital fatigue, because everybody's now online much more in terms of the people that we would speak to. You know, they're teaching online, they're preparing online content, they're in meetings online all the time. And how does kind of reaching out and saying, do you want to talk for an hour on Zoom for a podcast about teaching online, you know? But I think what's interesting is there's something about podcasting that feels separate. You know, the sense of being able to have a conversation in this way feels like, you know, certainly in terms of our experience in the last few months of asking people to do stuff when they're, you know, all they're doing is kind of talking online, is a sense of a kind of a respect and engagement with the space of actually, okay, well, if it's a podcast, then there's the chance to actually talk in a way that all the other times you're online, you're not necessarily able to do. And that's been really encouraging, that despite a kind of digital overload, podcasting still can retain a kind of special place in people's cultural engagement and how they kind of talk about things.
When this conversation goes on air, it will be December. Christmas is just around the corner, the perfect time to listen to podcasts. What topic will be addressed in that month's episode of The Cinematologist?
If it's December now, if we go forward in our podcasting time machine, then yeah, I think all of our main stuff will have been done. I think we're doing an episode on British social realism, which is probably the last one that will have dropped in December. But then I suppose Neil and I have yet to discuss what the end of year episode is going to look like. I know I personally, and this is the first time I've floated it, so I don't know what Neil's reaction to it. I personally would find it difficult, I think, to do a sort of traditional top five rundown of my favorite films of the year, because I don't feel I'm in a position to sort of make that assessment. So whether we do a kind of adaptation of that into something else will be an interesting question, I think. But actually, I'm sorry, Anna, it's a difficult question to answer, because we don't know if there's going to be an intermediate episode between the social realism one and our end of year one. So it's kind of, you'll just have to watch this space, I guess.
Yeah, the social realism one will be out because that ties in with a film release at the beginning of December. So that one is kind of, we know, coming up. And then there will be an end of year episode where we struggle to articulate what kind of year it's been in film. And, you know, I agree with Dario that it wouldn't necessarily be a traditional top five sort of rundown. But what's exciting is that we always struggle with that anyway, because of the amount of films and our place within the culture and when and where we see films. So I'm kind of feeling quite positive of just being liberated from having to worry about that and just being able to talk about five films that I've loved. But also, I think what I'm really looking forward to, which is something that I really enjoy about the podcast with Dario, is, you know, we don't get the chance to talk very much about the big questions. And this is a year of huge questions. You know, we always do a reflection on the year in cinema, and in the 5 years we've been doing it, the world and cinema as part of the world has never had a year like this. So it could just be 4 5-hour podcasts which take up the whole of December where we try and work out what the hell has gone on in film in 2020.
Whatever the final year episode will look like, it's worth listening to it. So I will listen to it even if it's 5 hours
long. Don't worry.
So you have me.
Dario wouldn't let me anyway, so that's fine.
No, we can't go on to open territory, that's for sure.
Many thanks. I regard this conversation as a kind of warm-up. It would make me very happy if we could introduce you soon as Bling of the Month. I mean, now we're in the news chapter, so we have this sort of progression to the Bling of the Month section. In that context, there is a book I would like to talk to you about, Podcasting, New Oral Cultures and Digital Media from 2018. You both edited. And the book accompanying podcast, New Oral Cultures, because The Cinematologist is not the only podcast you're involved with. And there is Dario's latest publication, which focuses directly on film podcasts with the title A Cinema for the Ears, Imagining the Audio Cinematic Through Podcasting. And of course, it would be great to get to know more about Neil's Sound Image Cinema. May I invite you again for a longer conversation?
Of course.
Yeah,
that sounds great.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. So I'm really looking forward to being able to ask you more questions again soon. Have a very nice Christmas and thank you very much.
Thanks, Anna. Same to you.
Thank you.
This is the Dear Diary chapter. I would like to tell you about the Dial S4 Screen Studies Conference, which took place from November 18th to November 19th. This was the conference where I heard Zenim's talk. Dial S4 Screen Studies is the annual Screen Studies Conference run by the Sydney Screen Studies Network. The Sydney Screen Studies Network is, and here I quote from their own self-description, a research-led group of scholars, students, and screen enthusiasts whose interests cover all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. The network welcomes members from across Sydney, Newcastle, Wollongong, and Greater New South Wales. For once, a positive side effect of Corona. Since the conference had to take place online, more international colleagues than ever before were able to attend. Participants from 13 countries gave presentations. I myself would not have traveled to Sydney for 2 days to attend a conference, but online I was very excited to be able to do so. I got to know such likable and smart colleagues. Everyone was extremely friendly and open and very well prepared. As a Screen Studies conference, there were of course a variety of papers offering different perspectives. For example, the impact of Corona on soap opera narratives and production was described and evaluated, as was the use of VOD platforms during the pandemic, emphasizing how the overcrowded content of VOD platforms can become overwhelming for recipients. But there were also numerous film studies papers, some of which explicitly referred to the pandemic and others that presented research without reference to the current crisis. For example, one paper dealt with film studies pedagogy in the era of remote learning and the maintenance of joint screenings in film studies. Laura Aish, practice-based researcher and freelance filmmaker, gave an insight into her own film practice during the pandemic and raised the question about what the value of working with limited space might be. Tim Laurie has examined the socialization of masculinity through violence in Australian true crime cinema. And Catherine Fowler situated the growing era of academic audiovisual essays with a wider field of practice-based research. Her objective was to look for patterns across this field so as to pose questions addressing the history of common strategies for practice-based research. I myself gave a talk on Humoris Corona videos, a topic beyond my current larger research project on film cities. I gave my talk not live, but offered a sort of video talk, a video essay. I mean, the time difference was 10 hours. To avoid having to give my presentation at 4 a.m., I was allowed to pre-produce my lecture as a video. My colleagues watched the video in so-called reading times. For the subsequent Q&A, I was of course live on Zoom. So despite the pre-produced video, I sat through an all-nighter, as they say. I listened to presentations and finally answered questions about my own paper, but it was absolutely worth it. I found the presentation and discussions very enriching, and somehow I found it exciting to turn night into day in the interest of research. Wherever you are right now, I wish you too some inspiring all-nighters, be it with great research projects, a podcast, marathon viewing, spending time with family, friends, or colleagues, or whatever else makes you happy. I wish you great end of December days and a good new year. Hopefully it will bring us together again. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.